everyone. It's time to read the Des Moines Register for Wednesday, November 10th, 2021. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHeck. For the first hour, we'll read state and local news from the Des Moines Register, along with selections from USA Today. Birthdays and announcements come at the top of the hour. We'll continue with news for another 30 minutes, then change readers. Our second shift will start with the opinion pages, and obituaries will be read at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m., followed by sports. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby and a weather recap. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. IRIS provides our 24/7 services and equipment to our listeners at no cost. If you would like to learn more about how you can help us keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong, give us a call at 515-243-6833 or visit iowaradioreading.org. And now let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for considerable cloudiness today with periods of rain during the afternoon, but drier near Des Moines. Our winds will be from the east-southeast at 8 to 16 miles per hour, and a soaking rain is expected tonight. The 7-day forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 55 degrees with a low of 40, with cloudy today with periods of rain in the afternoon, and tapering off tonight. On Thursday, a high of 52 with a low of 32, cloudy, becoming windier. On Friday, a high of 38 with a low of 25, very windy and flurries. Across the area, cloudy with periods of rain this afternoon. Our sunrise today was at 6:57 a.m. and will set at 4:59 p.m. Our moonrise today, 1:14 p.m., and the moon set at 10:46 p.m. And now let's take a look at the headlines in today's Des Moines Register. Parents raise concerns over LGBTQ books in schools, grain elevators to close as Metro grows, and Amazon Air begins daily cargo service at Des Moines Airport. And to get us started with today's Des Moines Register is Barb.
Thank you, Dennis. Parents raise concerns over LGBTQ books in schools. Concerns shared by parents at school board meetings across the Des Moines Metro in recent weeks over their children being exposed to LGBTQ content in library books reflect a national conversation about which books belong on school library shelves. In Waukee, Urbandale, and Ankeny, parents have taken issue with several books that they say are inappropriate for their children. The books include All Boys Aren't Blue, Lawn Boy, Gender Queer, and Hey Kiddo. The parents have argued the books are pornographic and obscene and should not be easily accessible to children. All Boys Aren't Blue, Lawn Boy, and Gender Queer have been temporarily pulled from Waukee and Northwest High School's libraries while a review process plays out. Gender Queer has sparked controversy and been removed from school libraries in states across the country, including Virginia, Texas, and Ohio. According to a statement from the Waukee School District, it is not uncommon for the content of classroom and library materials to come into question. The process to request a review of books or other materials, however, is typically meant to begin at the school or classroom level. Quote, a process of review per board policy will determine if each or any of these titles are returned to the library shelves. A statement from the Waukee School District reads, specifically, upon the conclusion of the review of each title, a recommendation will be made to the superintendent as to the future availability of these books in school libraries. Several Central Iowa parents have used school board meetings over the past month to share their concerns about the content of books available for their children to check out. Community member Amber McClanahan read passages from several of the books aloud at Waukee's October 25th board meeting. The excerpts, taken from All Boys Aren't Blue, Lawn Boy, and Gender Queer, contained written and visual depictions of sexual acts between boys and, in one case, relatives. This, McClanahan said, showing a graphic set of images, is also in the book, Gender Queer at Northwest High School, available for children as young as 14 to check out and read. In Urbandale, parent Dennis Murphy said he found the book Hey Kiddo in his son's backpack. The book is about a boy who lives with his grandparents and is searching to discover the truth about his family. Quote, I cannot write what I saw, but found 33 different pages that contain sexual and or slanderous / vulgar content that if spoken in my house would be grounds for immediate discipline, Murphy wrote in an email to the Des Moines Register. In a Facebook post, Ankeny parent Emily Archer shared concerns about four books, some with LGBTQ themes and some without, calling them pornographic material, that included depictions of incest, rape, masturbation, pornography addiction, anal sex, oral sex, violence, and so much more. Quote, the issue here is not acceptance or tolerance. I'll gladly discuss those topics another time, Archer wrote. The issue here is pornographic material, easily accessible to our kids at school. The issue here is a double standard. Should my husband or I willingly show this material to a child who came to our home, we'd be arrested. And rightly so. And yet, the books sit on the shelves of numerous schools here in Ankeny. Katie Christensen, another parent, read a passage from All Boys Aren't Blue at the Ankeny School Board's November 1st meeting. The message, from the collection of personal essays about growing up queer and black, described a consensual sex act involving two adult men. She called the material obscene and asked district officials if they were trying to desensitize children to, quote, grotesque sexual experiences, or if equity and inclusion made them want to normalize this type of behavior by introducing books about pedophilia and incest, end quote. An Ankeny district spokesperson did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Though many parents speaking out have expressed disgust at the content of LGBTQ-themed books, others have defended the content. At the Waukee School Board meeting Monday, parents heard about one book's intentions nearly straight from the source. Waukee parent Roxy Buhati, who has three children who have graduated from Waukee schools, read aloud a statement by Jonathan Everson, author of Lawn Boy. Everson says the book was, quote, intended to be a comfort to anybody, and not just young people, struggling with their sexual identity or trying to find their place in the larger culture generally. As much as these concerned parents would like to ignore the fact, their teenage children almost certainly have gay or gender-conflicted friends, the author said. This is a reality that they cannot shelter their teenagers from, and why would they want to? Bethany Snyder and her partner, Chris Kmall, both identify as members of the LGBTQ community. Their child, Zachar, is a fifth grader at Waukee's District Radiant Elementary in Urbandale. The family said they've seen conversations in other districts around books related to the LGBTQ experience and were disturbed by the comments. Quote, even more disturbing, two of them were written by LGBTQ people of color, which are all voices that often kids don't have access to and don't get to read about, Snyder said. It just seems so blatantly homophobic and transphobic and racist. Mall said he grew up in a conservative Christian household that limited his access to certain materials. For kids like him, he said a school's library may be the only resource available to kids to learn about themselves and read about other LGBTQ people. He said the discussion around the books has made him question whether Waukee is the right place to raise his and Snyder's gender-fluid child. It made me very sad that there could be kids out there that are struggling and have nowhere that they feel like they can go, and now they can't even check out a book in the library to read more about an LGBTQ person's life and experience, Mall said. Amanda Vasquez, chair of the Intellectual Freedom Committee of the Iowa Library Association, said she's noticed an uptick in challenges to reading materials in Iowa and nationwide. The majority of the challenges, she said, are related to LGBTQ-themed materials. She said not all books in school libraries are related to classrooms curriculum, pointing out that the libraries also serve to satisfy students' general interests. We would hope that everyone would respect everyone else's right to read or view whatever it is that they like, and for individual families to have those conversations with their children, either about what materials they should be selecting or about the materials that they already have selected and have read or viewed, she said. No one should try to prohibit anyone else from reading materials just because they themselves may not find them appropriate for their own family. Keenan Crowe, Director of Policy and Advocacy for One Iowa, a statewide LGBTQ advocacy organization, said the arguments aren't new. Crowe, who goes by they/them pronouns, said the conversation follows a familiar script used by those opposed to LGBTQ people's inclusion in public spaces. Quote, with every gain, with every time LGBTQ people or any marginalized community that has been previously pushed to the margins gets allowed access to public spaces, these kinds of things happen, they said. Crowe said that the vast majority of the books being targeted feature LGBTQ content. While they wouldn't completely rule out that there are books with truly objectionable content, they haven't seen it yet. They said the books coming up now are being taken out of context. The context matters, Crowe said. That's the most important part. They said that reviews by districts of whether a book belongs on library shelves should focus on the whole book and consider how it fills a gap of viewpoint and experiences in the library. Crowe said the question district reviews should seek to answer is the work taken as a whole appropriate, and not if page 57 of a 250-page book is offensive to me personally when I look at it. Dennis?
Thank you. Our next article from the front page of today's Des Moines Register. Grain elevators to close as Metro grows, pressured by suburban sprawl. Beacon on the Prairie to vanish from horizons of Altoona and Bondurant. When she makes the 11-hour drive after visiting her daughter in Ohio, Marquetta Oliver says seeing the 100-foot concrete silos at the Bondurant grain elevators is like a beacon on the prairie. When I see that big, beautiful elevator, I think, thank goodness, I'm almost home, said Oliver, Bondurant City Administrator. I love that. But after decades of operation, the elevator in Bondurant and another in Altoona will close next fall. Victims of age, damage from the August 2020 derecho, and most of all, pressure from the fast-growing cities that have risen around them. Having farmers go through town to get to us is problematic, said Matt Karsten, CEO of Landis Cooperative, the elevator's owner. Semi-trucks and trailers, tractors, grain carts, sprayers, and other big machinery must navigate city streets, roundabouts, and sometimes residential neighborhoods to reach the elevators in the two suburbs, which are northeast of Des Moines. We have facilities that are in the middle of two fast-growing cities, Karsten said. We just have to deal with those facts. Bondurant is the second fastest-growing city in Iowa, its population exploding 91% over the past decade to 7,365. The 2020 U.S. Census showed it has grown almost fourfold since 1990. Altoona ranked 18th on Iowa's fastest-growing list, increasing its population 35% from 2010 to 2020 to 19,565. It's growing 170% since 1990. Two big tech companies have helped drive growth in both cities. Amazon opened a nearly 3 million square foot fulfillment and sorting facility in Bondurant in 2020. Facebook has built roughly 4 million square feet of data centers in Altoona since announcing its first project there in 2014. The hundreds of new jobs those projects are generating bring additional residential, commercial, and other development. Across Iowa, development has gobbled up nearly 84,000 acres of Iowa farmland over the past two decades. Estimates Wendong Zhang, an Iowa State University economics professor. Although higher corn and soybean prices over the past year are the main factors in driving Iowa farmland to record highs, the conversion of acreage into homes, shopping centers, and industrial sites is a contributing factor, Zhang said. He points to a farm south of Cedar Rapids that sold this fall for a record $26,000 an acre. It's not the farmland's rating for its corn yields that's getting the premium, Zhang said. It's the location that's garnering the premium. The money from those sales often goes to buy more farmland. Selling 80 acres near Ankeny can get you 300 acres in Webster County, Zhang said. While the amount of farmland lost to urban sprawl over the past decade is significant, it represents less than 0.5% of Iowa's 23.7 million acres of corn, soybeans, and other crops. And even with reduced land available, Iowa's production continues to improve. This year's harvest is expected to rank among the state's largest for corn and soybean yields, despite a widespread drought. The Bondurant and Altoona elevators were built in the early 1950s. When landists assessed their status after the derecho, their age was beginning to show. The cooperative decided to close both facilities after serving farmers through next year's spring planting. The organization is looking to develop a new regional grain operation that will serve both Altoona and Bondurant area farmers, but Karsten said Landis has yet to settle on an easy-to-access site. The decision to close the elevators is tough for many farmers, said Bryce Kappel, who farms near Maxwell but grew up bringing grain to Bondurant with his father. Farmers have really backed the grain elevator, said Kappel, an associate Landis director. There's a lot of loyalty and love for the co-op, but there comes a point in time when you have to do what's safe for farmers, the communities, and the elevator employees. It's hard for me to picture Altoona without that landmark, said Mayor Dean O'Connor, who grew up in the town, but I understand their reason for leaving. Both the Bondurant and Altoona elevators sit near the city's historic downtowns, and city leaders say repurposing the nearly 60 acres they occupy could create opportunities to expand their small city centers. O'Connor said he would like to see the Landis site in Altoona redeveloped, providing space for small businesses. I see kind of a smaller version of the East Village in Des Moines, a mixture of shops and boutiques, entertainment and services in new and redeveloped older buildings, he said. Altoona has a growing retail and an entertainment district along I-80 with outlets of Des Moines, Bass Pro Shop, Prairie Meadows Racetrack and Casino, and Adventureland Amusement Park. A downtown site could be a less expensive place for entrepreneurs to get started than prime locations on major highways, O'Connor said, providing a needed spark for an area that has stalled out for the years. It could really help the businesses that are there, he said. Oliver, the Bondurant city administrator, also sees the Landis property in her town providing new office, retail, and entertainment opportunities. Downtown already is seeing reinvestment, including Reclaimed Rails Brewing Company, which opened in 2015, and space under development for a pie shop. The city's former train depot is easy site for the Landis elevator, serves as a trailhead for the nearly 30-mile Chautauqua Valley Trail, drawing bikers, hikers, and other outdoor enthusiasts, Oliver said. Having the trail right there is a huge benefit to our downtown, she said. Oliver hopes that whoever buys the land to develop will incorporate the elevator silo in the project. The elevator and agriculture are part of the city's heritage, she said. The city has grown up around the elevator. Landis, which is based in Ames and has about 60 locations in Iowa, found in its post-derecho assessment that the concrete silos in Bondurant and Altoona were weakening. The hurricane-strength storm in August of 2020 swept through the state, flattening trees and crops and damaging homes and businesses. Karsten's, Landis CEO, said that throughout the nation, cooperatives face challenges with infrastructure that's 60 years old or more and needs to be replaced. It's similar to the nation's struggle to maintain and replace highways and bridges. Ryan Bristle, a Landis board vice chairman who farms between Woodward and Boone in central Iowa, said a new location will help farmers get in and out of the elevator faster and more safely. Speed is especially important in the fall when farmers are harvesting their corn and their soybeans in a narrow window before rain, sleet, and snow hammer the state. And grain-loaded semis can have a hard time navigating city streets. For example, a detour in Altoona sent trucks through residential areas this fall. Everything is getting bigger, Russell said. It's a challenge, no matter where you're at. And then combine that with growing towns that are harder to navigate. There's a safety concern for not only the farmer, but for the community, too, he said. A truck full of grain can weigh 80,000 to 90,000 pounds, and it's hard to stop. Karsten said the cooperative will look for a site on a highway that can survive urban sprawl, even if it again encircles the operation. Zhang, the ISU economist, said it's difficult to guess where urban growth will go next. Sometimes cities can help guide it with zoning and by building roads, trains, and other public transportation infrastructure. But sometimes it happens organically, despite a city's best efforts. Development can leapfrog instead of growing concentrically from a city's edge, said Zhang, pointing to growth between North Ames and Gilbert as an example. Bristol said many Iowa cities and towns wish they had the steady growth of places like Bondurant and Altoona, part of a surge that has made Des Moines the fastest-growing large metro in the Midwest. I understand that a lot of people want a small town to stay a small town. They don't want anything to change, and that the elevator often is its heart and soul, he said. But for the most small towns, not changing is not positive. Barb?
Amazon Air begins daily cargo service at Des Moines. Amazon Air begins daily cargo service at Des Moines Airport. Amazon Air, the air cargo carrier for the Seattle-based e-commerce giant, began daily cargo service Tuesday at the Des Moines International Airport. The move, analysts say, inches the company closer to achieving same-day delivery of many of its products in central Iowa. The airport leased 8,052 square feet in an existing facility and 32,475 square feet of adjacent tarmac and other storage areas to Trago Dugan Aviation, an Amazon contractor that will operate the cargo hub. The inaugural Amazon Air flight arrived shortly before 3 a.m. Cargo was unloaded, and the plane took on a new load before departing again at 6:18 a.m., an airport news release said. It's the first gateway for Amazon Air in Iowa and supports shipment of Amazon customer packages throughout the region and country, said a statement from the airport. The number of jobs at the hub was not released. Amazon Air's arrival in central Iowa comes as the company is investing hundreds of millions of dollars to build delivery infrastructure in the Des Moines Metro and elsewhere in Iowa. The work began in 2018 with the establishment of a delivery center in North Liberty near Iowa City. A massive expansion began the following year with the construction of a 3 million square foot fulfillment center in Bondurant. Since then, it has built or opened a 247,591 square foot delivery center in Iowa City, a 110 square foot delivery center in Grimes, a 278,000 square foot sortation center in Bondurant, adjacent to the fulfillment center, and a 137,000 square foot warehouse in Ankeny. Under construction are a fulfillment center in Davenport and a 270,000 square foot sortation center in Council Bluffs. And all signs point to Amazon as the tenant for a planned 1.08 million square foot warehouse and distribution center in Woodward. It would have the largest single floor footprint of any facility of its kind in the metro. Mark Wolfert, president of the Canada-based supply chain consulting firm MWPVL International Incorporated, and a close student of Amazon's expansion, said the establishment of the Des Moines air cargo operation was a predictable part of the company's plan for Iowa. The next nearest gateway for Amazon Air is Kansas City International Airport, nearly 200 miles away. Quote, Des Moines is geographically remote and has a metro population of 635,000 people, so it needs to be connected to the rest of the country to enable two-day delivery for Amazon Prime customers for products that are stocked elsewhere in the country, Wolfert told the Des Moines Register Tuesday. Amazon initially jumped into air delivery service back in 2015, building up its cargo operations in an effort to avoid delays and maintain its rapid e-commerce growth, according to reporting from the Seattle Times. Since then, Amazon Air has expanded operations to more than 40 airports in the U.S. and over a dozen international locations, according to research published in September by DePaul University's Chardock Institute for Metropolitan Development. The cargo airline, the research says, maintains a fleet of 73 planes. Amazon Air's expanded reach, bolstered by its ability to rapidly move inventory among its multitude of warehouses and sorting services to make next-day delivery possible for an enormous array of products to much of the U.S. population, said the report, titled Blue Sky Population. Titled Blue Skies for Amazon Air, the expanding capabilities of Amazon's cargo airline. Amazon so far has invested around $250 million in Iowa, adding around $200 million into Iowa's gross domestic product, according to Amazon spokesperson Caitlin Polachek. That's not counting the warehouse plan in Woodward. Codenamed Project Hawk, it is slated for Woodward Eco Business Park, just south of Iowa Highway 141. City officials say they are sworn to secrecy about the company behind the project. But the name of the project is not unlike the initial code name used for the Bondurant Fulfillment Center. Project Blue Jay, when it was under a similar secret pact. Also, just as with that project, an application for state funding to help pay for a roadway surrounding the facility says the company behind Project Hawk strives to be Earth's most customer-centric company, Earth's best employer, and Earth's safest place to work. The phrase is identical to one on an Amazon public relations website describing the company. Wolfert said Amazon's growth in Iowa is only just beginning, with same-day delivery for the Des Moines Metro likely within the next 2 to 3 years. They will likely be adding delivery stations to Cedar Rapids, Sioux City, Davenport, Waterloo, and Dubuque over time, Wolfert said. Des Moines will likely in the future be getting a 150,000-square-foot same-day fulfillment center, as Amazon calls it. The smaller fulfillment center stocks around 100,000 of Amazon.com's most popular products, so the company can offer a 5-hour delivery window. Dennis?
Thank you, Barb. And to continue with the Des Moines and Iowa news, we'll move over to the Metro and Iowa section. Reynolds says, talk to a pediatrician about vaccine for your kids. Healthcare experts have said the vaccine is safe for children. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds encouraged parents of children between 5 and 11 years old who are now eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine to talk to their pediatricians about it. Reynolds, a Republican, stopped short of recommending outright that children get the vaccine, as she has encouraged eligible adults to do. Like I have said all along, that is a personal health care decision, and parents are in the best position to make that decision, Reynolds told reporters Tuesday morning following a manufacturing-focused event in Pella, about 45 miles east of Des Moines. So we encourage them to have that conversation with their pediatrician, take in all the information, and make that decision going forward. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention approved the Pfizer vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11 on November 2nd, making more than 280,000 Iowa children eligible for the shots. The pediatric dose is a third of the amount of vaccine in the adult dose and is shipped and packaged separately from the adult dose. Even though it's a fraction of the size of the adult dose, it still provides a robust immune system response. University of Iowa Healthcare Chief Pharmacy Officer Mike Brownlee said in the lead-up to its final approval. Children still need a second shot, 3 weeks after the initial shot, to reach full immunity. Healthcare experts have said the vaccine is safe for children. Even as children are less likely to face long-term severe consequences from COVID-19, those risks far outstrip the risk of a smaller but still effective dose of the Pfizer vaccine, according to Dr. Rami Botros, Director of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa Healthcare. In fact, side effects from the vaccine are even less than what was seen in adult populations, he said. Reynolds said the state is receiving its allotment of vaccines for children, so clinics are ready to offer the shots. We're making sure that they are distributed to our public health and our clinics across the state, and so they're ready to go to deliver those vaccines if parents decide that's what they want to do for their children, she said. Reynolds also said Tuesday that she hasn't yet received a booster shot of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine and plans to consult with her doctor about it. I just haven't yet, she said. I got my flu shot, and so we're out on the road and focused on that, and we'll consult with the physician and make that decision later. Federal regulators approved boosters of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine on October 21st. It was originally conceived of as a one-dose vaccine. Reynolds received her J&J vaccine in March at a live televised news conference as she urged Iowa adults to get vaccinated. On Tuesday, she said it's important for Iowans to get out there and do the right thing by getting their flu shot. She said there's concern that this year's flu season could be bad, and getting vaccinated against the flu is important to prevent overwhelming Iowa's healthcare system. I focused on the flu shot because there is a timeline where it's really important to do that, and right now it is really important, she said. If you haven't gotten your flu shot, I would encourage you to go out there and get it. Iowa may soon join a third lawsuit against a federal COVID-19 vaccine mandate, Reynolds said Tuesday. The governor said Iowa is looking at joining a case against a recent mandate issued by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that requires all health care workers at facilities that are receiving federal Medicare or Medicaid funds to be fully vaccinated by January 4th. She said other states are still working out whether they will join the case. Iowa is already suing, along with 9 other states, over a vaccine requirement for employees of federal contractors. Separately, the state has joined a lawsuit over a vaccination requirement for businesses with more than 100 employees. A panel on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has temporarily blocked the mandate for large businesses, which was also set to take effect on January 4th. Reynolds said she hopes that the rule continues to be blocked while the legal challenges proceed, and then we'll let the courts really work through whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional, as we believe that it is, she said. Barb?
DMARC relocating to South Des Moines. A Des Moines area nonprofit is getting a new home. The Des Moines Area Religious Council, or DMARC, an organization dedicated to helping meet residents' basic needs, is relocating its headquarters to Des Moines' South Side, according to a news release. In conjunction with the announcement, DMARC is also launching a $5.6 million capital campaign called Food Today, Change Tomorrow to fund the relocation. Since 2014, the nonprofit has been operating out of twin buildings in downtown Des Moines. One houses the administrative offices, while the other is a rented warehouse that holds food and other supplies for its 14 brick-and-mortar food pantries and 30 mobile pantries. With an 80% increase in people served through its network, the nonprofit says it was imperative that they relocate in order to better serve the community. Last year alone, DMARC hit an all-time high, serving about 59,000 unique individuals. On average, an individual will visit the pantries 3 to 4 times a year, but there are also individuals that use pantry services every month. We are facing a moral imperative that if we do not move to a bigger, more effective space, we are knowingly setting ourselves up to leave many hungry children, seniors, and families behind, DMARC Chief Executive Officer Matt Unger said Tuesday. The new headquarters, located at 100 Army Post Road, will triple the amount of available warehouse space and revolutionize the organization's cold storage capacity with the addition of a giant cooler and freezer. Quote, the new facility will ensure DMARC can respond to the emerging levels of food insecurity in our community, deepen interfaith relationships and partnerships, and advocate for systemic change, Emily Webb, a DMARC board member and chair of the DMARC Capital Campaign Cabinet, said in a statement. Unger said the larger space will also help a nonprofit avoid having to turn away food donations and rescues for high-value items like strawberries and other fresh produce because of lack of storage. There's been a number of times we've had a truck we just couldn't take. Recently, we had a truckload offer of strawberries. Strawberries are awesome. They're expensive. We can't buy them. So that truck itself was worth about $50,000. Now, in that case, we were able to scramble, Unger said. There will also be an on-site food pantry added to the new location, which will increase the number of food pantries on the city's south side. Currently, Bidwell Riverside is the only food pantry available on the south side and is, therefore, the busiest pantry in DMARC's network. We're very proud to partner with them, but they're up against it every day, Unger said. So to be able to take a little bit of that strain off them and then also have more evening and weekend hours available for folks in this part of town that don't have access to anything like that right now, we think is going to really be helpful. The nonprofit is currently working to sell its current headquarters at 1435 Mulberry Street, with plans to put the proceeds toward the $5.6 million capital campaign. So far, DMARC has raised $1.5 million. Renovation on the new headquarters began in the spring and is slated to finish in early 2022. Dennis?
Thank you. Tireless advocate for farmers, ISU professor Neil Harrell dies at 88. Neil Harrell, an Iowa State University agricultural law and economics professor who pushed for bankruptcy reforms during the 1980s farm crisis, died Thursday in Ames. He was 88. Harrell, who was the Charles F. Curtis Distinguished Professor of Economics at Iowa State University, had a long career in academia, but may have been best known for two things: devising a plan to slow the demise of family farms and leading the unsuccessful fight to block the sale of ISU's WITV in the 1990s. In the 1980s, as record high interest rates skyrocketed farm debt to untenable levels and a U.S. embargo on grain exports to the Soviet Union cut markets, Harrell urged banking and congressional officials to allow farmers to restructure debt. His proposals helped create a path so farmers could continue operating and lenders could recoup part of what they were owed without resorting to foreclosure. He was a very strong advocate for agriculture and for Iowa farmers during the 1980s farm crisis, said Terry Branstad, Iowa's governor during what remains the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression for Iowa, affecting more deeply than the 2007 through 2009 Great Recession. Farmers invested heavily in farmland and equipment during a 1970s agriculture boom. In Iowa, the subsequent crisis saw farmland values tumbling 62% to $652 an acre by 1987. A Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation history shows farm bankruptcies created a downward spiral, with values falling as more land came onto the market, creating a glut. Iowa lost thousands of farm equipment manufacturing and food processing jobs, driving the state's unemployment rate over 9%. The state's population saw its biggest declines in record, falling 4.7% between 1980 and 1990, as people left to seek work elsewhere. From 1982 to 1987, the number of Iowa farms shrank by 10,233, the U.S. Census of Agriculture shows. Described as tireless and brilliant, Harrell devised a plan to halt or slow bankruptcies and foreclosures that sent a shockwave through Washington, one consultant said at the time. Harrell's proposal had two main elements: a government buy-down of farm loan interest rates and a land holding tank to keep foreclosed property off the market and stabilize land values. When the Farm Credit System Relief Law was passed, it included parts of Harrell's plan, although he felt it didn't go far enough. The idea was that everybody gets a haircut, with lenders, the government, and farmers each absorbing a share of the loss, said John Lawrence, vice president of Iowa State University Extension and Outreach. In Iowa, Harrell backed legislation that created two important laws to help farmers, said Neil Hamilton, former director of the Drake Agricultural Law Center. One required lenders and farmers facing foreclosure to go through mediation. Another gave farmers the right to catch up on delinquent payments instead of immediately accelerating the entire debt, said Hamilton, a former student of Harrell's. The mediation requirement stopped the clock and enabled farmers and lenders to have conversations that could lead to restructuring debt, extending the length of the loan, or forgiving part of it, Hamilton said. Created as a result of the law, the Iowa Mediation Service, a hotline for farmers experiencing financial stress, continues. That could be part of Dr. Harrell's legacy, creating a set of legal protections for farmers and also an approach to ag lending that's more cooperative and understanding, Hamilton said. While Hara worked closely with Branstad to lobby the White House and Congress during the farm crisis, the two parted ways 10 years later when the State Board of Regents voted to sell WITV, the commercial station ISU established in the 1950s. Hara and a group of other faculty, alumni, and friends formed Iowans for WITV and waged a bitter battle to block the sale. The group, using money gathered through a formidable fundraising network, sued the Regents, arguing the sale violated state law. The group won in district court, but saw the case overturned by the Iowa Supreme Court. It took its fight to the U.S. District Court in Washington in an attempt to overturn federal regulators' approval of the sale, but lost. Speaking this week, Branstad said Harrell had a distinguished career. He will be greatly missed by Iowa farmers because he was somebody who really understood agriculture, said Iowa's longest-serving governor, who served from 1983 to 1999 and 2011 to 2017. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, an Iowa Republican, said few knew more about agriculture policy than Harrell. He was aggressive in defining the problem and offering solutions to the problem, Grassley said Tuesday. Harrell also gained an international reputation as director of the Center for International Agricultural Finance. The center brought finance and banking officials from around the world, particularly the former Soviet bloc, to Iowa to study Western banking practices, including central banking, lending, regulation, and other subjects. The banking officials attended seminars at ISU and served internships at Iowa banks and regulatory agencies. Besides bringing foreign bankers to Iowa, Harrell and other center workers traveled extensively through Eastern and Central Europe to teach seminars and classes on banking. In 1994, he led a team of ISU professors who advised then Ukraine President Leonid Kuchma on the newly independent country's plan for privatization. Harrell's colleagues held him in such high esteem that many signed petitions to have him named president of ISU when W. Robert Parks retired in 1985. Harrell said he was elated when he learned he wasn't a finalist. I didn't realize until then that I was not prepared to give up what I was doing, he said later. The high office was a long way from Seymour, just a short distance from the Iowa-Missouri border, where Harrell grew up, the son of a tenant farmer who struggled through the Depression. Starting with the spring lamb, Harrell developed his own livestock operations as a youngster and earned $2,200 when he sold out in 1951 to enroll at ISU. Harrell had planned to return to the farm after graduation, but instead spent 2 years in the military and 1 year as a field editor for Wallace's Farmer magazine in Des Moines. While on assignment for the magazine, he met John O'Brien, a professor in the University of Iowa Agricultural Law Center. The talk convinced him to enroll in law school and specialize in agricultural law. Harrell went on from law school to earn a doctorate degree in agricultural economics at ISU, where he began teaching in 1964. Over the years, he wrote hundreds of articles and books, including a 15-volume, 10,000-page treatise on agricultural law. He was the founding president of the American Agricultural Law Association and president of the American Agricultural Economics Association. Colleagues described Harrell as a tireless worker. He was truly remarkable, and Iowa and the nation are better off because of Neil, said Paul Lastly, an ISU sociological professor who worked with Harrell and other ISU professors to help Iowa farmers. In 1952, Harrell married Darlene Harris, salutatorian of the couple's graduating class at Seymour High. They had two sons, James of Denver, Colorado, and Rodney of Bedford, New Hampshire. After his family, Harrell's next love was farming. He and his wife bought 1,000 acres in Appanoose County, including the 1863 family tract in which he was born, and additional tracts that his family had farmed as sharecroppers throughout his youth. Harrell and his wife wanted to create a gathering place for undergraduates and in 2013 dedicated the Neil and Darlene Hall Commons on ISU's campus. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at Adams Funeral Home at 502 Douglas Avenue in Ames. The funeral service will be held at noon on Saturday at First United Methodist Church at 516 Kellogg Avenue, also in Ames. Burial will be at the Iowa State University Cemetery. Preceding Harold's death were his wife and brother, Richard. He was survived by his two sons and five grandchildren and two sisters, Marjorie Sutter of Ames and Myrna M. Donald of Waterloo. Harold's family requests that in lieu of gifts, donations be sent to ISU to support the Dr. Neil Harrell Opportunity Award, number 270620, a scholarship fund. Back to you, Barb.
And in another recent loss, we have a feature remembering former U.S. Representative Neil Smith. Flags to be lowered to half-staff to honor him. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds ordered flags to be flown at half-staff today to honor former U.S. Representative Neil Smith, who died last week at age 101. Smith, a Democrat from Altoona, was first elected to Congress in 1958 and represented Central Iowa in Washington, D.C. for 18 terms, from 1959 to 1995. Iowa's longest-serving member of the U.S. House of Representatives died November 2nd at his home in Des Moines. A private funeral will be held at 10 a.m. today, followed by burial at Perry Center Cemetery in Packwood. A live stream of the funeral will be shown at hamiltonfuneralhome.com. Smith was born March 23, 1920, at his grandparents' home in Keokuk County and served as a bomber pilot in World War II, receiving a Purple Heart and other decorations. He married Beatrix Havens in 1946, and the couple had two children. Beatrix Smith died in 2016 at age 92. Flags will be flown half-staff at the Iowa State Capitol and the Iowa State Capitol Complex, according to a news release from the governor's office. All public buildings and facilities throughout Iowa will also have flags lowered. Quote, Representative Neil Smith was an American hero and a true Iowa treasure, Reynolds said in the news release. He faithfully served our state as Iowa's longest-serving member in the U.S. House of Representatives and leaves behind a storied legacy in our state and across our nation. And we have a number of photos from Neil Smith's history. I'll run through a description of those. First, from 1947. It shows Neil Smith at the age of 27 sitting at his kitchen table reading from law books while his wife Bee and 8-month son Douglas look on. Both Neil and Bee were Drake University Law School students at the time. And from 1950, Iowa Young Democrats at their state convention at the Hotel Fort Des Moines are pictured. The attendees shown are Louise Powers of Hubbard, the group's Iowa National Committee woman, Allenson K. Elgar of Mount Pleasant, state president, State Senator D. Wilson Gilmore of Metton, Missouri, national president, and Neil Smith of Des Moines, national committee man. From 1961, Neil Smith poses with a Soviet student on the grounds of the Kremlin in Moscow, Russia. Smith said the boy approached him with an attitude of both curiosity and friendliness. Smith and six other members of the Education Committee of the House of Representatives spent a week in the fall of 1961 touring schools in Moscow and Kiev in the new Ukraine. From 1967, Neil Smith is pictured working on a stone wall behind his home in Fairfax, Virginia, from which he made a 35-minute commute into Washington, D.C. each day. Neil put down 23 tons of Virginia limestone, his wife Bee Smith said of the wall, and had back trouble for 3 months. He has also pictured his four-footed supervisor, who is the two-year-old Alfie, the family St. Bernard. From 1967, in the U.S. Capitol's Hall of Statuary, Neil Smith is pictured stopping for a discussion with Arkansas Representative Wilbur Mills, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And finally, from 1989, U.S. Representative Neil Smith is pictured laughing with Drake University President Michael Ferrari before Drake's graduation ceremony. Smith was a 1950 Drake Law School graduate and was awarded an honorary Doctor of Laws. The university's legal clinic is named the Neil and Bee Smith Law Center. Bee Smith, also pictured, was also a 1950 Drake Law graduate. Neil Smith said he wished his first degree had been so easy to get. Dennis?
Thank you. A short article here from West Burlington. West Burlington School Board seat winner decided after name drawn from bucket. With the grabbing of a random piece of paper from a red bucket, The West Burlington School District has learned who will serve in the vacancy at-large seat for the next 2 years. Excuse me. Write-in candidate Vanessa Johnson's name was pulled from a bucket during the Des Moines County Board of Supervisors meeting at the Des Moines County Courthouse on Tuesday morning. Johnson and retired West Burlington School District Secretary Mary Storch both tied for the seat, with each getting 6 votes as write-in candidates during last Tuesday's election. Iowa law requires tie votes for in a public office to be settled by an official election canvasser by placing the names of candidates on separate pieces of paper, placing them into some kind of receptacle, and publicly drawing the name to declare the winner. Supervisor Shane McCampbell had the honor of drawing the name from the bucket. The vacancy at large seat will be replacing West Burlington Board member Pam Dodds. Dodd temporarily joined the board to fill a vacancy after Dan Hockett resigned in 2019. Also, survey to assess state of free speech on campuses. Faculty, students, and staff at Iowa's 3 public universities saw a survey about the state of free speech in their inboxes Tuesday, and it's been long in the making. The first survey of its kind is being administered at the behest of the Iowa Board of Regents Free Speech Committee, convened last year in response to what President Michael Richards called, quote, disturbing incidences and trends at the university, and will aim to assess the state of free speech on the 3 campuses. Recipients have until December 1st to answer the questions. A group of institutional research and diversity leaders developed their survey in conjunction with the Board of Regents, according to Regents spokesperson Josh Lehman. It will break down the responses by student, staff, and faculty. Questions about the handling of free speech at the University of Iowa, at Iowa State University, and the University of Northern Iowa caught the attention of Iowa's Board of Regents as well as state lawmakers last academic year. The incidents in questions typically involve politics. The Regents Committee on Free Speech is responsible for handling complaints about potential issues, about reviewing policies, conducting surveys every 2 years, and implementing speech-related training. That training, which is also a first for the Regents schools, will begin in the spring semester. The Regents and Iowa Community Colleges are undertaking the training together under a contract with a company called Six Red Marbles. Along with making plans for a survey and training in late February, the Regents approved new guidelines requiring universities to add policies and procedures, including penalties for violations of free expression, to existing policy language. The board also created guidance barring members of college leadership from taking institutional positions on policies unless it's in conjunction with the Regents. The issue of speech on campus came to a head in February when leadership from the 3 public universities were called to testify before the legislature's House Government Oversight Committee about separate events on their campuses. The most notable incident that caused ire for some lawmakers took place in October of 2020 within the University of Iowa's College of Dentistry. College leadership, including then Dean David Johnson, sent a college-wide email criticizing the Trump administration's executive order on combating race and sex stereotyping. Dentistry student Michael Braze replied to the email chain showing support for the order and asking for further clarification about the school's position. College leadership summoned him to a disciplinary hearing for unprofessional conduct. Braze contacted state legislators with concerns that his right to free speech had been violated. The disciplinary hearing never happened. Johnson has since resigned. In February, he apologized to lawmakers about the events. We do not want any of our students to have an experience that leaves them feeling unsupported or fearful, and we failed Michael in that regard. And to be honest with the committee, we have heard from other students, faculty, and staff, and our colleagues that we have failed them as well, Johnson told lawmakers. A number of Republican lawmakers expressed concern during that same time that the events at the dentistry school speak to a broader culture at the University of Iowa. I can speak to direct testimony from my members who feel, rightly or wrongly, that there's a different set of rules, one for conservative groups and one for liberal groups, said Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican from Wilton. This is a repeated, decade-long, and probably even longer, feeling of hundreds of students, if not thousands, that there are two different set of rules. Other events related to free speech drew public attention last fall. In August of 2020, an Iowa State professor syllabus said students could not choose any topic that takes at its base that one side doesn't deserve the same basic human rights as you do. That would mean no arguments against gay marriage, abortion, Black Lives Matter, etc. The university took corrective action against the professor in response. In October of 2020, University of Northern Iowa student government leaders denied a student request to form a local chapter of Students for Life of America, a national nonprofit that opposes abortion, arguing that the group could create a hostile environment on campus. Barb?
Thank you. Some families face divide over vaccines while making plans for Thanksgiving. This report by Leanne Natale, writing for the Associated Press. Thanksgiving is Jonathan Mitchell's favorite holiday, usually spent with his wife, co-hosting up to 20 loved ones. He'd been looking forward to the gathering this year after calling it off in 2020 due to the pandemic. But one of the most pressing issues of the times got in the way: who's vaccinated and who's not. Mitchell, 35, of Coon Rapids, Minnesota, has a rare neurological disorder called Klein-Levin syndrome and a smattering of related health issues that leave him at high risk should he contract COVID-19. Two relatives, his father-in-law and a brother-in-law, won't get vaccinated. Rather than laying down an ultimatum doomed to fail, the Mitchells called off Thanksgiving, choosing instead to host a Friendsgiving the following day. Mitchell's vaccinated wife will catch up with her family on Thursday. The situation, which Mitchell said is upsetting and frustrating, resonates with many families navigating the vaccination divide for the holidays. Thanksgiving is a bellwether for how the rest of the season will go among those facing family conflict over the shot. Quote, "This is a line in the sand I'm willing to draw with others," Mitchell said, of the choice to confront his unvaccinated relatives. "I've cut off a handful of friends and acquaintances that are staunchly anti-vaccine, but you can't do that with family." That sentiment, echoed by others, points to a transition in the pandemic from abject fear over public safety to a more long-term and intimate reshaping of social norms, said Carl Erickson, a professor of sociology at Grinnell College. Families often kind of mute conflicts, and, because we paused in a way that's really rare for families, the restarting of ritual gives us a moment to reconsider things, she said. There will be new hesitancy. A lot of people who are vaccinated might not be willing to go to an event where the host hasn't asked or doesn't know. Carrie Verrocchio, 55, of Binghamton, New York, is a long-haul COVID-19 survivor, still struggling with loss of taste and smell 10 months after testing positive. She's hosting about 11 for Thanksgiving. Five are unvaccinated. "All have been informed," she said. "You just want people to be happy and be together, and it feels like there is constant friction. No matter what we do, there's constant friction these days," says Verrocchio, who took the vaccination after contracting the virus. "We're handling it by letting everyone make their own decisions. It isn't ideal, but it is a plan." Lizzie Post is a great-great-granddaughter of etiquette legend Emily Post. Her famous relative wrote her first book, Etiquette, in 1922, not long after the Spanish flu took its deadly toll. Emily made no mention of how to navigate such a threat in that first edition, but the subject today is hard for her etiquette standard bearers to ignore. "It's a really delicate subject, and it's not going to go well for everybody," said Post, who is co-president of the Emily Post Institute, host of the Awesome Etiquette podcast, and author and co-author of several books on etiquette. "A lot of us have gotten used to general entertaining since vaccinations have been in play. That means we actually have experience with it, and we know where our standards are for ourselves. But there are some really good reasons to back off and say, you know, maybe the big family thing isn't worth it if it's going to be so fraught," she said. The avoidance of fraught is exactly the approach Eva Keller and her husband are taking for Thanksgiving. He has been vaccinated. She has contracted COVID-19 twice and has no plan to get the shot. There was no talk of Thanksgiving with her husband's kin. "My husband's family has made it clear that I'm not allowed inside any of their homes until I'm fully vaccinated," said Keller, 7, of Anaheim, California. "My husband only got vaccinated because of his parents insisting. He was concerned his mother would worry herself to death if he didn't. The two will spend Thanksgiving at home together. Erickson sees other pandemic strands at play heading into the holiday season. There are also questions, she said, like how did this person or this family navigate the pandemic more generally? Do we share values about what this last year has meant for our families? Do we stay in touch? Have we reconnected enough to share this holiday? August Abbott answers etiquette questions at thejustanswers.com, a helpline that has more than 10 million monthly visitors. Of late, she has been responding to a barrage of questions about holiday gatherings and vaccinations. Among them, is it rude to ask for a guest vaccination status? Can I disinvite somebody who isn't vaccinated? Quote, it's kind of like Typhoid Mary. Do you invite her to dinner knowing she's Typhoid Mary? Or do you explain to Mary, I'm sorry, we can't take a chance. We love you, but we can't take that chance. That's what you've got to do with unvaccinated people when it comes to COVID, most especially if someone in your household is elderly or immunocompromised. This is just a matter of health and respecting each other, not political, she said. Tone, Abbott said, is everything. Frederick Bushaber, 36, of Cincinnati, will be gathering for Thanksgiving with 13 family members at his mother's house in Knoxville, Tennessee. The group includes his husband and their 15-month-old son, Freddie, who has Down syndrome, which puts him at higher risk for complications should he contract COVID-19. Bushaber's 88-year-old grandmother, who lost her husband this year, was supposed to be driving from Florida to Knoxville with an aunt and uncle. They're not vaccinated. They won't be coming after his mother had the Thanksgiving vaccination talk with them. That means Grandma must board a plane alone for the first time without her husband. I'm not thrilled about that, but I'm just happy I get to be the winner of this, he said.